Watching or listening to Redwood Wonk. My name is Eric Kirk. I'm with David Frank. We're discussing national political news of the day, and we're getting pretty close to Christmas, and you would think there wouldn't be so much to talk about, but I had to choose between a lot of different stories. But I think the first one we're going to talk about is, why is the media wimping out? They seem to be bending the knee to Trump. And, of course, the biggest story is the CBS settlement of a lawsuit. I'm sorry, they couldn't have lost. They could not possibly have lost that lawsuit.
ABC. It's ABC.
ABC, right. Oh, did I say CBS?
Yeah.
Apologies. ABC, George Stephanopoulos had referred to Trump as having been an adjudicated or rapist. I can't remember the exact term now, but it was, but it basically used the word rape in it. He was sued. The problem that I have with the settlement is that he was pretty much quoting the judge. Excuse me. The judge was basically stating that in New York legal concepts that sexual assault is interchangeable with rape. And so it appeared in the decision. So he's basically repeating that. But at worst, it was hyperbole. And under the standard of New York Times versus Sullivan, it should have held. Politicians and other famous people are not supposed to be able to intimidate a network this way. And my concern is that this is going to lead to other crazy lawsuits and other people, media surrendering. Today, or yesterday, Trump's attorneys filed a lawsuit against the pollster for Des Moines Register, for crying out loud, because she got the poll wrong. I mean,
a big suit too, right?
Yes. Like, yeah. I mean, you know, it's a big deal, and so that's just absolutely goofy, or it used to be goofy. I mean, New York Times versus Sullivan was a very important decision in 1964, in which it was held that if you're a famous person and the media covers you and you've been defamed, or you've been hurt by the coverage, and it turns out to be a falsehood, the requirement is malice. Either a deliberate misstatement of the truth or a reckless disregard for the truth. That's a tough standard, and that would have been a real hard one, and it also protects hyperbole. So if they were saying that Stephanopoulos was a commentator and he was using hyperbole to describe Trump, that's fine, but they issued an apology and $15 million, not anywhere near as much as Trump was asking for, but still, this was a surrender that I think is unprecedented. I mean, the principles of the major media, they're supposed to stand up to this. Even if they lose, they're supposed to do this because, again, the implications for media coverage of political figures, especially a president like Trump, is major. Now, there were reports that Disney, who owns ABC, had people meeting with Trump in Mar-a-Lago a couple of days before. And apparently, you know, there's a lot of speculation that they're concerned that Trump was going to do what DeSantis has been doing, which is to use regulatory and other executive power to basically hurt their assets and investments. And so did they settle this case basically to avoid those types of repercussions? But it's not just ABC. That's the biggest news. But Joe Scarborough and his wife, I'm forgetting her name already. Did you know
Mika Brzezinski.
Mika Brzezinski, who have been, you know, cornerstone of MSNBC's opposition to Trump for a long time, all of a sudden, after the election, went to meet with Trump and talked about how they're going to take a different attitude. And they're getting a lot of flack. I think about a third of their audience has said that they've dropped off. And Scarborough is basically yelling at them, telling them they're idiots. I mean, you know, you don't get to tell the customer. The customer's always right, Joe. So, you know, if you made a mistake, that's it. You don't know your customer base. And then even into the alternative or semi-alternative, although I think that some of the accusations are unfounded, but the Young Turks have come over a lot of scrutiny from podcasters and other YouTubers. It's kind of nasty, actually. I mean, from Vanguard to Midas Touch to all of them, they're slamming them as basically selling out to Trump. I'm not sure that one's is justified. Anna Kasparian has actually been expressing a change of heart with some politics for quite some time now, arising from the way she was treated by certain media figures after she was sexually assaulted by a homeless man. And she's had a change of mind about several issues, going from the crime issues and enforcement to the border, which she just recently went on Glenn Beck and just said, I was crazy. The right wing is completely right about the border crisis, to even trans issues, where she accuses the trans defenders of maybe going a little too far. I don't want to say that they've moved to the right. They're making comparisons with other people that have done so. I mean, they're still talking populism, you know, Bernie Sanders style, but they have a different take than they did, and it's being interpreted. The rest of that genre of media have turned on them, and their subscription basis has tanked a bit. They were the number one, I think, for a while on YouTube, they certainly aren't now. But I got to question all these other people that they've got nothing better to cover than what's going on at the Young Turks. If I was to basically hold, you know, be at a meeting with them, I'd say we don't have time for this. You don't worry about what Anna Kasparian and Cenk Unger are doing. Just do your own thing. I mean, you know, they'll drop off and you'll pick up. But the point of this is that the media is kind of going crazy, saying, well, you know, if you can't win them, join them. Not everybody. I'm not seeing any much changes in Chris Hayes. I'm not seeing changes in the New Republic or In These Times or any of those sources, but enough of them that it could place them in kind of a danger. And two justices, Thomas and Gorsuch, have already talked about overturning New York Times versus Sullivan. I think that the right wing would regret it if that happened, because it would be a flood of lawsuits against Fox News and Newsmax and all of the podcasters. I'm going to let you jump in here. I've got a lot more to say, but yeah. I'm going to let you jump in, Dave.
I was going to ask you, before I jump in, can you mention New York Times lawsuit, what that overturning that would mean?
I mean, they basically...
Case law precedent.
Yeah, it would open up more possibilities. If basically they drop that malice standard, then it just becomes one of negligence. And if the media will then be much less likely to cover stories if there's any ambiguity whatsoever. Even if they try to report it as, we're not certain here, but this is what's being said by this individual, it will open up floodgates. And this was a case in which the New York Times had been sued for defamation out of a situation involving the civil rights movement. And particularly government officials, but any celebrity has that power to be able to use their money to intimidate any type of media. Well, it'll certainly affect the smaller media, who just can't afford to defend against those lawsuits. There is some anti-slap protection now, but if the New York Times versus Sullivan standard changes, then slap, the anti-slap laws is based on, you know, whether or not you've got a likely possibility or probability of prevailing on the merits. That's going to change. So this is really dangerous. What ABC did, whatever their reasons, was a huge disservice to freedom of press in this country.
Thank you, because I think as a lawyer, you're better positioned than myself to make that case. And I think it's a really important angle for people to prism to view this all through. I think, you know, before I dive into the specifics, you know, as always, thank you for the setup. Our entire media ecosystem has been very siloed, I think, and we're, you know, that's pretty much a very widely accepted phenomena that, you know, there are, for example, you go to Fox if you're right-leaning, you go to CNN, sure, if you're left moderate, you go to MSNBC if you're further left than that. If you're disgusted with mainstream media, you go to indie media, and that's some, you named some indie media. So it's within that context where mainstream media is losing their client base, and they're at risk of their financial model failing. That I think that's a great starting point for this, for us to say, you know, the way you framed this was, you know, potentially why is it that ABC capitulated, given that the defamation, the bar is so high. And that it's such a hard threshold to meet. Well, what I saw recently is that this settlement came right before the deposition and discovery phase. And because these are almost always thrown out, meeting that malicious intent standard, it leads, you know, speculators to believe that Trump's position may have been, look, we believe we're going to find something, we're going to find a smoking gun, that there was some malicious intent. You could have just, you know, ABC, George Stephanopoulos personally, could have gone ahead and said, you know, used the actual sexual assault phrase when in this line of questioning. But because of the power behind the word rape, and there is, you know, you sort of have to proactively intend to be more vindictive in your choice of words. So I think that's the, you know, I'm speculating here, but the potentially insurance company lawyers may have just advised ABC's lawyers, or by extension Disney's lawyers, that look, if you cut this check now, you cut your losses. You're probably not going to lose in court, but you don't want this in the press. And moreover, you want to maintain your relationship with this administration, and they're on a tear and they're going to hit the ground running. You want to be on the right side of history here. So that's, I think that it's, you know, it was a poor choice of words, arguably for George Stephanopoulos, especially because of what you said, that according to the federal law definition, according to New York state law now currently, you're on the right side of things if you do use the words interchangeably. But at the time of the verdict, technically that was not the case in New York, which therefore, you know, Trump's lawyers maybe felt that they had a leg to stand on here. So that's, you know, I think this does set a very dangerous precedent, sort of categorically. You know, the media, newspapers have always vigorously defended their rights to publish and use the words that they choose to use, because they're almost never maliciously intending to harm public figures. So there's that. There's that piece of it. But I want to pivot to Mika and Joe Scarborough, the Morning Joe show. This one is a little different, or arguably extremely different. This is not like, hey, a large company doesn't want to be in the crosshairs of a Trump administration with Elon's Department of Governmental, what's Doge, the E part, Department of Governmental Expenditure, right. I think. Yeah. So nobody wants to be in the line of that, right? But this is very different. This is Mika and Joe and their show and their clientele and all their guests for the months leading up to this election, and prior to that even. It's widely known that that the Morning Joe show was President Biden's favorite show, and that the White House used this show for messaging. They had a two-way relationship going. Worse than that, though, you know, this show actually went so far as to call, and the hosts or at least Joe Scarborough, went so far as to compare Donald Trump to Hitler. So so there's that. And then so this pivot to going down there and meeting with Trump, they went on the air to defend their practice of speaking with those who they disagree with. But the criticism was extremely harsh. And really, they've been called out for hypocrisy, you know, that they just they lost half their viewership after this happened. And more more broadly, the whole station has lost half their viewership, approximately. CNN also. So this is, I would say in this case, it's most likely capitulation to maintain access, which is exactly how you framed this this segment, which is bending the knee. I'll say really briefly, because I know we just have a couple minutes left. When it comes to the Young Turks bending the knee, I don't think that's actually what happened. I think
I don't either.
Yeah, they the climate of blame and fear on the left is you know powerful, and right now it's really the crossfire is just you know hard to wrap your head around. And the question is, who are you going to blame for the loss of the presidential election? There's a fear of what comes next. To be honest, I've been watching the Young Turks for many years, and they have always talked about working class solidarity. More recently, they've talked about transcending party. So I think this is very on brand. And in this climate, they've just expressed a willingness to focus on policy, meaning they keep an open mind where they think it'll improve the lives of American citizens and their families. And so I think they reserve their criticism for actions that impede improvements. And so sometimes they are targeting the center and the left, and people are taking offense at that. I think that's different than bending the knee.
I agree. I just want to really quickly clarify, too, is that the judge referred to it as rape, saying that it's it was commonly understood, even if it didn't fit New York's narrow definition. But as the, he was referencing the common reference to rape, that should have been the cover. I don't know what else they would have uncovered in discovery, but that should have been the cover to protect it. And, you know, it's just that you lose credibility as a media organization now. MSNBC is ripping them. Other media people are ripping them. In part, real quickly, the drops after an election, the news people, particularly in a partisan nature, the viewership does drop after an election. It will pick up again. Whether or not certain ones will pick up as much as others, we'll see. But
Fox News did go up too. I saw the most recent stats. Fox has gone up.
Yes, that's right. But yeah, but they're like the sole network. Everybody else, you know, has to split between all the rest, and it's just and Fox News people are hyped up, the others are depressed. That's going to last a while. Anyway, we are out of time on this, but ABC really messed up here. That's my final word, my final opinion. So, in a related topic, there is all this talk of revenge, and a lot of people thought that, well, it was all hyperbole for during the Trump to basically energize his base, but it looks like he is serious about this. He made some comments today about Elizabeth Cheney being in a lot of trouble. You see what he's doing with the media, he intends to fire people into problems. Is going to clean out the Department of Justice of all the people who didn't go along with his coup attempt 4 years ago. He will, whatever of them are left. And he is talking about, you know, canceling licenses and going after everybody on the January 6th committee. It looks like he intends to do it. The people he's seeking to appoint are definitely talking that way. Certainly the new head of the FBI, if he indeed does get through the approval. This is kind of scaring people. And so Trump or pardon me, Biden has already pardoned his son. You know, and politically, I say that was bad. Ethically, I say it was questionable. But as a father, I completely understand it. I would not want to leave my son vulnerable to the insanity that Trump is talking as to what he's going to do afterwards. So people are saying that Biden should just pardon everybody who's associated with the January 6th committee, everybody in Congress who voted for impeachment, everybody on all three jurors that have ruled against him, issued verdicts against him, and maybe every reporter in the country who's covered him. I mean, you know, I mean, it's just, and then others have suggested that he give a blanket pardon, criminal pardon, to all of the undocumented immigrants. I don't know if you can do that. I think you have to name them, so that would be quite a task. But Biden has already issued a very disappointing pardon of that judge, Cash for Kids. Judge, I'm really disappointed in that, but I'm always disappointed in pardons. I was disappointed in some of Obama's. I don't even want to tell you what I thought of Trump's, pardoning of his buddy in the case. But I don't want to get too far in pardons. I want to focus on, is he going to issue a campaign of revenge? And is he going to exploit, if not abuse, the presidential powers to do it? Dave?
Yeah, so thank you, as always, for that setup. I think that speaking about Trump's revenge, and we could have addressed this in the last segment, maybe, but really this is the more appropriate place. He, as a private citizen in business, it's well documented that He has always used the legal system as another, arrow in his quiver of power. And so if he needed leverage over people, or he just needed another counterweight against other people's power, he has a track record of using lawyers and the legal process for that. Right. As this, as his political career has taken shape, and this had some highs and lows, and now it's back to the high. I think that, he has said God knows how many times that, he's retribution for all the people who the government's power, whether it's police power or regulatory power or the power of elites over working folks. I think that that's a huge part of his worldview, but also over his projected image. So, like you said, he's already threatened lawsuits over against media and like that pollster, for example. They're saying that that was a malicious. It was a known. I forgot the exact verbiage the press press person said, but basically they're saying it was election interference. They're going after it as election interference. From the perspective of political enemies, he's also projected that, for example, January 6th people will face legal scrutiny. And there are Trump supporters who have also said that, have supported this approach and sort of started a grandstanding process inside government and outside government through the press, that's an approach they plan on taking. So my takeaway from Trump's, what should we expect from this administration is there is no reason to expect discretion over his professed plans for retribution. I think it's coming. With respect to pardons, I hate to say it this way, but like you said, it's been the Hunter Biden pardon. What we talked in a prior show about how that was a novel pardon that said for crimes that you've been charged with, crimes you may have done, but just not, it's never been charged with. And by the way, it's between this entire period from when Joe Biden left the vice presidency to the time he leaves the presidency. There's some degree of, we've talked about how you would want to, of course, protect your own child. And there is a highly partisan climate there. But there's also some there when it comes to being an unregistered lobbyist for foreign interests. So it's not purely political. So
no, but I guess the question is, would he have issued that pardon if anybody but Trump was coming to office.
Perfect segue to, it was defensive. Exactly. I don't think he would have needed to. And the question is, does he need to? So since that pardon, like you said, there's been some, there's been this pardon of the cash for kids scandal. I remember back to almost every president has done some pardon where you're like, you just wonder why a scandalous person got a pardon. It's probably money, power, history between their factions, right? Like who are we to say why some potentially suspect person got the benefit of a presidential pardon? But so that cash for kids aside, there have been calls to say, why don't you proactively pardon folks who might be part of that Trump retribution that we spoke of? And, if you have committed a crime, you probably want a pardon. If you have not committed a crime, a pardon is probably going to look really bad. And so I think I heard Adam Schiff say recently, publicly at least, he said he doesn't want a pardon.
Right.
He's done nothing wrong.
No, he said bring it on.
Yeah. And because in part, we could talk about private citizens after this, but you've got the speech or debate privilege that Congress members have. So they basically, if I'm reading correctly from the statute, they shall in all cases except treason, felony and breach of the peace be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session of their respective houses and in going to and returning from same for any speech or debate in either house. They shall not be questioned in any other place. So in other words, they can say whatever they want on the Hill and there's no law that can touch them.
Are they going to be investigated for what they said or the context they made and the conspiracy, to defame the president? I think that's what they're going at, is they don't want, they're claiming that it was all a conspiracy to overthrow the government or to anyway. Yeah.
Well, no, I think it's not in any way. I think that's actually you're right where me and you are on the same page, because Liz Cheney was also, and Adam Kinzinger, Republicans were also on that January 6th commission, committee rather. So like Liz Cheney's situation is that they're saying she was obstructing justice by tampering with a witness. So again, you and I from where we sit, we don't get to see all the details. But what some of the Republicans have been saying is that that Liz Cheney was approached by, sorry, that Liz Cheney approached Cassidy Hutchinson.
Right.
And when she was still she was still had a relationship with a lawyer that was provided by Donald Trump. And there was, they have messages, right? They have the receipts, so to speak, of a two-way communication between them. And that we know that after that messaging, that Liz Cheney provided a list of potential lawyers. I think she actually said, it's possible that we shouldn't be talking to each other, but if you want other lawyers where we could, our relationship would be less suspicious, basically like, here's a list of lawyers. And she did in fact take up one of those lawyers. So who knows how much of the communication between that committee and the witnesses, probably no tampering, but you could imagine a scenario where it's hyped up big time.
That's not tampering. That may be inappropriate ex parte contact. But then Liz Cheney wasn't acting in the capacity of an attorney. She was so that would be iffy. And that would take it. But that's not witness tampering unless you can prove that Cassidy would have testified otherwise, but was somehow intimidated or bribed or something by Liz Cheney. That's the only thing that could get her in trouble for tampering. But again, I don't know what they're going to put together. What they would put together. This is, they are literally out to get her and others. And so.
Yeah, I would say before I hand it back to you, I know we probably don't have a whole lot of time left on this, but the sort of bigger picture here is that concept of lawfare, which is warfare using the courts. That's been really pushed during the last year, that supposedly, the deep state, the existing Biden administration, White House, that there's some you know, collusion between legal powers, whether federal, state, sure, local, county, that Donald Trump has been sort of, you know, alienated and isolated. Let's just use the word targeted, like that this lawfare concept has been to keep him down a peg and keep him out of the White House. The whole Republican base has heard this messaging for like at least many months, if not longer. So then the question is, well, what do you do? Do you fight fire with fire? I think Donald Trump will have broad support for saying, hey, this, you know, turnabout is fair game. That right. when the legal system is all the everything's pointing at me, don't be surprised when I have the legal system on my side and I put all my people in charge.
As long as it's jury trials, I don't object. Juries are the checks on this type of thing. Jury, you know, everybody saying, oh, well, the jury, that was a New York jury, it's just bias. That's being said by people who have not served on a jury. Juries take their jobs historically very seriously. I have initially been angered with jury votes, jury decisions that later I thought, no, I guess based on the jury instructions they got and the evidence that they actually were presented with, their verdict makes complete sense. Example being O.J. Simpson. I just thought, how could they get him? They got his DNA. Well, when you've got an officer, lieutenant, who is caught with the DNA stuff that should be back in the lab, and he's got it out at the scene where they supposedly found it, you know, that's a real serious question. But I hadn't been paying close enough attention to the trial to understand that he had done that and lied about it and doubled down on his lie, even after being shown by the photographs, because there were like 5 million media people there with cameras, right? You can't get away with that stuff. But, you know, as the saying went, the LAPD proved themselves so inept they couldn't frame a guilty man. But it's just, but I initially I thought that was a horrible decision. But, you know, based on the evidence, I can point to other decisions like that. And no, a jury is selected. You've got both sides using their peremptories to exclude. It is a bedrock aspect of our system. So as long as Trump's, the DOJ and the rest are seeking jury trials, I don't care if they find the reddest area to do it. Juries tend to take their job very seriously. And so, you know, it's not lawfare or if it's being put in front of a jury, because they don't have no control over that outcome unless there was jury tampering. But if we would know that by now.
Yeah, I think just kind of last thing here, I did see a stat. I grabbed it here. That the Obama administration, the pardons that they put in place were relatively limited, and that here it is. President Obama issued 212 pardons and 1,715 commutations, including 568 people with life in prison. Trump granted 237 acts of clemency, 143 pardons and 94 commutations. So that's what we have in our recent history. Apparently, Biden's already granted clemency to nearly 1,500 people. And right. And so there, you know, I heard from Karen Jean-Pierre from the White House press podium that Joe Biden's the first president ever to issue categorical pardons to individuals convicted of simple use and possession of marijuana and to former LGBTQI+ service members convicted of private conduct because of their sexual orientation. So
I haven't even followed that part of the story. Good for him.
Yeah. So that's what people have been calling for him to do. As recently as like today, I've heard people calling on that, but apparently that already happened and people missed it. So maybe they're not really hyping it up, or the media is kind of not covering it. What I have heard is that there's a call for like all of the people in federal prison for nonviolent offenses related to marijuana, that those should all be granted clemency or pardons because of the shifting social values across the majority of the country that sees that as a victimless crime, not significantly worse than recreational use of alcohol. So the question is, will President Biden show leadership on that, in that front? But also just more broadly, how much of the of those sort of how much has politics infected this process, basically, is the question. Like will there be other categories of preemptive pardons just because of the sort of hyperbolic political nature of our climate? And we'll see over the next 4 weeks.
I mean, Ford pardoning Nixon, who hadn't been charged with anything, was political. Sure, you go back to the beginning of pardons, they're political. Yeah. That's, by definition. Anyway. Yeah.
Today, we celebrate the triumph not of a candidate, but of a cause. The cause of democracy.
We are going to raise issues that, historically have not been raised.
What about the nuclear option, doing away with the filibuster? I can tell you that would be the end of the Senate as it was originally devised.
All of this is possible for America. Who was standing in the way? Mitch McConnell.
Where an insurrection that sought to overturn an election, when that failed, the action moved into state capitals.
This brings us to our last topic, we're discussing unions. Unions have made a lot of gains over the past few years. They had a president walk one of their picket lines. They've managed to. If you're a union, your real wages actually exceeded that of inflation over the past few years. Maybe not for everyone else, but definitely for them. And I wouldn't say that that's due to anything that the Democrats have done in terms of policy. It's just they have been fighting and going out on strike in labor activity that we haven't seen of the likes since the 1960s. Now, labor unions in the 1980s went under some attacks. The Reagan administration passed some amendments, the Taft-Hartley, to make things even harder. Right to work laws were passed, and meanwhile, a whole union busting category of law firms in union busting were using bankruptcy laws to break out of union contracts, particularly in the airlines. So we've seen unions have declined over the years. I think it after World War II, something like 30%, maybe even 40% were unionized. I think we're down to the teens or something like that. And if you exclude the public unions, it's even worse. But they've made their gains. They've had wins against Amazon. There's possibly going to be another strike, a Teamster strike against Amazon, that could cost $5 billion a day. That might happen right before Trump comes to office. But there is also the Eastern International Longshoremen's Association, the East Coast one, and the United States Maritime Alliance. The negotiations between them broke down in mid-November, after they averted a strike, and they suspended a strike. Well, they're back on, and one of the big issues is, of course, replacement of workers by automation. The companies don't want to commit to keeping carbon-based workers in place because it'll hold them back from the future, and they won't be able to address a lot of issues. But Trump knows his politics. He made a statement in support of the dock workers, probably because he wants to avoid that strike, because that strike, he's not going to be able to control inflation if that strike happens, to have the whole Eastern Seaboard shut down by strikes. And if they're anything like the West Coast longshoremen, they will shut down those ports. So will they fare very well? Well, then going back to the Labor Relations Council, Biden had actually removed one of Trump's appointees before. Trump will probably attempt the same, but the law is a bit tricky, and he may not be able to. But the National NLRB,
National Labor Relations Board.
Last year made a decision that if you were caught cheating or using unethical or illegal means to suppress a union, you get the union thrown on you automatically. That's almost certainly going to change if Trump gets the majority, which he will on the board. So so he is pro-union, sort of. He got a little bit of a good reception from the Teamsters. That's gone up and down with the Teamsters, because the Teamsters, again, are threatening a strike with Amazon, which also wouldn't help the economy. But he did have a Teamsters, the Teamster head, show up at the RNC to speak. The Teamsters asked to be at both. The Democrats stupidly did not invite him to theirs. That would have just nullified the whole political effect of it. But they were, you know, they wanted to control everything that was going to be said, and he wasn't in the inner circle. I mean, again, that rigidity is why Harris lost, but I don't want to revisit that. Will unions fare better or worse? I would say if history is right, they're going to fare worse. Trump is going to pay some lip service to the unions, but he'll stab them in the back the minute he gets it, and he'll do it with the support of Americans, because, you know, the Teamster head was actually getting booed by some of the people in the crowd at the RNC for some of the things he was saying. There's a lot to talk about here, but are unions going to lose their momentum under Trump? Well, that depends on the unions. As to whether or not they're going to bend the knee the way the media is, or fight for the rights of their employees. I mean, there are plenty of strikes planned for next year, and this could be a problem for Trump.
Thank you for that setup. I think there's a sort of a high level cut that I made when I was considering how we were going to talk about this today. And that, you know, when you look big picture, about 1 in 10 workers in America is in a union. But if you break that out, which is about half of what it was 40 years ago, but if you break that out by private sector and public sector, private sector is only like 1 in 20, so about 6%. Public right. sector is almost 33%, so that's like 1 in 3. So when we ask this question, how severe will the harm be in this administration? You could imagine a scenario where the private sector, there's some working class values that have been expressed by the Trump campaign and the people around him. You could imagine it based on what you've heard. But I think that just sort of as a marker in the sand here, a line in the sand, as it were, Trump is on the record. I listened to the audio tape again just to make sure I could hear him speaking to Elon Musk, praising him. And he basically said, hey, I love what you did, equating going on strike with quitting, meaning like there's a track record of saying you will not have a right to strike. You will not have a right to collective bargain. These are non-union people. But like the idea is that, you know, Elon's people were, you know, very much under the rule of a leader who was not friendly to organized labor. And Donald Trump said, I like the cut of your jib, right? So that we know that on a person-to-person basis, that's kind of where their heads are at. So I'm going to focus instead on the public sector. You talked a lot about the private sector, mm-hmm. you know, just because we have limited time. So they are planning, this Trump administration has said in many different ways, they plan on a massive overhaul of the federal employee system. That's 3 million people. So that's one out of every 100 Americans almost is a staff member of the federal government. Federal labor unions, about 25% of those people are represented by a union. That gives them collective bargaining agreements. That gives them third-party arbitration to air their grievances if they feel that that something in the workplace needs adjudication. If we look back at Trump's the end of his first term, he passed 3 executive orders limiting federal employees' bargaining power, including this. We're going to hear more about this. The Schedule F, which reclassified federal workers who were under collective bargaining agreements into the category of workers that are considered political appointees. What that translates to, not in Schedule F necessarily, but generally speaking, most people, it's called a right to, you know, you have at-will employment. You can quit anytime you want, and your employer can fire you anytime they want without violating your civil rights. If there are particular civil rights violated, that's a different story. But union protections are very different than at-will. Well, it turns out that, you know, what is the overall expectation based on not just what Trump did at the end of his first term, but what they've been saying, and also the people he surrounded himself with. So incoming staff on his new campaign and his new administration include America First Policy Institute folks. For example, Linda McMahon, Secretary of Education, Brooke Rollins, Secretary of Agriculture, Scott Turner, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. These are people that come from America First Policy Institute. And according to Ben Alinsky from the Center for American Progress, he said, quote, they are absolutely going to attack unions. There is no question. Yes. And to paraphrase, he said they do have an actual plan, and they have folks who've been thinking about this since the last Trump administration. When you factor in Project 2025, some of the things in there that have been in there, they want to prohibit federal labor unions from having a formal grievance process. They want to move federal employees to at-will employment, like I mentioned. In fact, there's a current member of Congress who proposed just this past week the Merit Act, which would codify the anti-labor wish list and really facilitate the mass layoff of federal workers. I could keep going here, but I just am curious from the, you know, federal worker, from the public sector, what are some of your thoughts?
I mean, there are civil service protections that have been that were the product of the progressive era that are supposed to protect, you know, people that are not in political positions so that they can't be fired for without cause. But as we know, Project 2025 has called for the firing of about 45,000 federal workers with their replacements with loyalists that they've been recruiting at political events, you know, beginning in Iowa and, you know, prior to the presidential campaign. So will those laws hold up? I don't know. Will the unions be busted? I don't know. And I think that Trump will try to push a narrative through the right-wing media that public worker unions are different from other unions and try to make a distinction there. It's going to be all out as to whether or not they're going to be able to pull it off between the union contracts and the it's really going to depend on the labor movement as a whole and whether they put up with it. The problem is after the general strike in Oakland of 1946, Taft Hartley passed a law that said sympathy strikes are illegal. But there's loopholes there. And so the labor movement is going to have to really join. And again, the Teamsters, who have been sort of back and forth in their politics, have said that strongly oppose mass firings and are already making a big deal about it. So what's going to happen? I don't know. But the unions are going to really have to flex their muscle and not leave the public federal unions hanging out to dry.
Yeah, there's a person that I saw put a comment out there. Her name is Jacqueline Simon from the American Federation of Government Employees, which I think is the largest federal employee union. She equated this Trump administration with an attack on federal workers, and by extension, an attack that's going to be harmful to the American people. So she gave the examples of USDA meat inspectors. If you deregulate that industry on one end and you cut the staffing on the other end, you run the risk of a less safe food supply. And with crossover, you know, outbreak of infectious diseases from animals to people, then we could have the next pandemic come simply from, bureaucratic attacks on the bureaucratic system that is currently trying to enforce that safety, those safety standards. She also mentioned Social Security and Veterans Administration. So these are vulnerable people, and that if the staffing that provides those services to Americans who have earned those services, it's really rather than saying, hey, we're going to save a little bit of money on reducing labor costs, it's really, people ought to think of it more as we're going to reduce services to the point that will be potentially harmful to American people. So that there's basically, just to sum up, that she described this cascading effect that this will have, and we will feel the ripples. I think also I know I want to pivot back to a more general. I know you started with the NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, but for folks who don't know, much of what they do isn't just massive micromanagement of labor relations, right, between companies and their employees. They just simply don't have the staffing. But what they do is they set the climate and the tone and the environment. And so maybe you might have a 1 in 100 year chance of getting an inspection, but you take it very seriously, because if you do have an inspection of some kind of your practices, it will affect your organization's reputation and bottom line. So what I saw a labor lawyer describe as the way they operate, what their power, much of their power comes from their the board general counsel, and that staff change from the Biden administration to the Trump administration could simply result in any of those memorandums that were issued being just completely reversed. So, for example, I'll give you just one example that'll hit home with folks: surveillance. The right of your employer to practice surveillance of you while you're at work, whether it's video or keystrokes or any other way that they're going to basically spy on you while you're working. Track you in a company vehicle. Right now, there's a memorandum that really starts to advance some degree of privacy, requiring employers to disclose it to the employees unless there's a highly justifiable reason. That could just be gone with a stroke of a pen. Another one that I think is really important is they put in place that if an employer systematically messes with people's wages and basically steals from them through some process, right now, that there's a memo that says any of those NLRB arbitrators who engage directly person to person with those companies and their lawyers, they have a directive. They cannot settle for anything less than 100% of back pay and benefits owed. Whereas you could imagine in any given legal settlement before that memo, you say, oh, you have harmed your employees for, $100. You have to pay back $50. Let's have a happy medium and let's get you on the right track in the future. Now it's nope, it's 100%. So it's a lot of things like that where the small incremental power in favor of labor that happened during the Biden administration, they can all kind of disappear with just some an issuance of a memo.
We're going to have a lot more to talk about these things, and probably when the NLRB, I don't know why I can't say that, issues are settled, we'll probably have to bring this up again for another segment, but we've run out of time. That brings us to predictions. What do you have for us, Dave?
So I'm going to hit you with some facts before I give the prediction. 72 million people rely on Social Security in America. 50% of retirees rely on it for 100% of their retirement income. 79% of Americans say Social Security should not be cut in any way. And 78% are opposed to raising the full retirement age to 70 years old. So clearly, Social Security is considered the third rail of politics for a reason. There was a massive uproar during the State of the Union address last year in January when Biden mentioned that Republicans have proposals in the works to make cuts to Social Security. They yelled liar, and they hipped and hollered that he was just making that up, that no Republican had ever said such a thing. Well, fast forward to the present, incoming President Trump has promised not to cut core retirement portion of Social Security, although he has floated modifications to disability in Social Security. Now that the Republicans control all the levers of power in D.C., congressional Republicans have an opportunity to make any spending cuts that have previously been floated by the many conservative groups that really want to make these cuts. With members of the Department of Government Efficiency laying down the marker that they plan on trimming $2 trillion from the U.S. federal budget, the social safety net programs are clearly the largest slices of that fiscal pie. So what happens when an unstoppable force meets an immovable object? Well, my prediction is that entitlement reform will indeed be a major component of the next U.S. government budget, that Social Security will be in the mix and be considered for big cuts. Furthermore, rather than focus on expanding the revenue by increasing the cap to shore up its solvency, I think these conversations are going to focus on cutting both the size and the growth of the program, despite the promises to the contrary.
I mean, that would guarantee that they lose the Congress in 2026. I think it would be stupid, but they're stupid. But anyway, I want to get to my prediction. We have two nominees. Pete Hegseth for the has been picked for Defense Secretary, and of course we have RFK picked for his position, RFK Jr. A lot of kind of hippie Trumper, semi-Trumper supporters are really happy with the idea of RFK Jr. being in there, but he's saying some things that are really getting Republicans nervous, and he is losing support in Congress. Meanwhile, Pete Hegseth, whose nomination seemed like it was going down the tubes, Fox News is circling the wagons and preparing a major assault, probably on any of the women who've made accusations, as they always do. And by the time we get to the hearings, it's going to be the women who are on trial, not Hegseth being evaluated for his position. My prediction is Pete Hegseth will be the next defense secretary, but RFK Jr., too bad, hippies, he's out. We'll find out if I'm right, but until next time, stay informed and stay engaged.